Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. So welcome everybody to the... the Alcohol Free Life podcast live. How amazing. It's so lovely that you were able to come to this fantastic place that we all absolutely love in Drury Lane in Covent Garden. And I just wanted to share with you, before we get started properly, just a little bit about how this particular evening came about. So lots of you here, give me a cheer, are Sober Club members. Look at that, amazing. And on our private group, we obviously have lots of discussions about whether we're going to meet up and all of that kind of thing. And every now and then we get something together. But a few months ago, Cindy, who is from Australia, yay, there she is, and Evan, who's from the States, were finally planning to come to the UK. And they've been planning this trip since 2020 or something, but they were finally planning to come to the UK. So they made some mentions on the group of how they'd really like to meet other Sober Club members while they're in the UK. And so I said, well, I'll set something up. You know, let's set up a Sober Club meetup. We can do that, no problem. What date are you going to be in London? So they told me. And I thought, okay, that's no problem. We'll just get a little Sober Club meetup together. And then Cindy sent me a message and said, actually, to be truthful, no offence, but I'd really like to meet Claire Pooley. Okay, you know, if you could fix that. Okay, well, you know, I've got some connections. So I said, I'll see what I can do. So then she sent me another message and said, I'd love to meet William Porter. Okay. And we haven't been to Club Soda yet. Okay, it's all coming good. Now, it was when she said, could you arrange for Russell Brand to come too? That I had to say enough already. I wish. So thank you, Cindy, for making it happen. And how amazing that it just so worked out that a couple of weeks after we're doing this live event, it really is the 250th episode of the podcast. I mean, I seriously can't believe it. And I've never had a week off. Can you believe that? And my top tip, if you're thinking of doing a podcast, is don't do that. Do a season and then have a few weeks off, right? That's what a normal person would do. But I didn't do that. Mainly because I have so many incredible, amazing guests. And, you know, I can't not keep going when I've got such incredible guests. So the first few weeks of the launch of my podcast, all those years ago, were I can't remember exactly the order. I think Laura was one of the first guests, Laura Willoughby. Catherine Gray was on very early on. Claire Pooley was on for one of several times. And William a little bit later. So these are people who have been so much part of the podcast and so much part of my personal journey that it's just amazing to have them here tonight. So I'm super grateful. So just to share with you, for those of you who don't know, a tiny bit about what happened for me way back 5.5 years ago. I was one of those people who had gone round the block more times than I care to remember, of thinking I'd ditch the booze and then going back to it. I was literally not, as all of you know, didn't have a rock bottom moment. I was, you know, what they call high bottomed, although sadly I wasn't really that either. So I was completely functioning, but absolutely not okay. And waking up at 3 a.m. every morning, pretty much, with a little voice in my head saying, what the hell are you doing? You're meant to be a well-being advocate. You're talking about organic food and skincare without chemicals, and you're knocking back best part of a bottle every night. What are you doing? Stop it. And I would make a little bargain with God, who I didn't know whether he was listening or not, but seems like probably was, because I used to say, well, I promise, dear Lord, that I will never drink again so long as I don't have a hangover tomorrow, because I've got a really mad day. So God kept his part of the bargain, and I rarely had a hangover, such was my tolerance. But then by 6 o'clock, sadly, the wine, which was in my ear, saying, don't be so goddamn ridiculous, don't be so boring, have a Sauvignon, you know, you deserve it. And it would all start again. So this went on literally for years as I stepped around this elephant in the room that was alcohol. I don't think there was ever a point at which I don't think I knew what to do. I didn't know how to get free from that trap, because I knew I wasn't at rock bottom, so none of the services were relevant to me, and I had no idea that anyone else felt the same way. It seemed to me that there were those people who were at rock bottom and could use support, and I definitely didn't fit that category. But I had no idea that there was anyone else. I thought everyone else, everyone I knew, all of my friends, colleagues, were very happy drinkers, thank you very much. Every now and then couldn't hold their beer, but mostly all good. I had no idea that there were millions of other people also waking up at 3 a.m. And so that was when Claire Pooley came into my life. In the form of a book handed to me by my producer at Radio 2, and if anyone's ever worked in media, you'll know that if you're going to be interviewing an author, you're normally given a night, if you're lucky, to glance at their book. That was usually the case. But this happened to be Christmas. So I was literally handed the Sober Diaries on something like the 20th of December. And the producer said, oh, have a quick look at this, because we're interviewing the author on the 4th of January. I swear to God, I looked at that title and I knew right then, oh God, something's going to change. So obviously I didn't read it till after Christmas. I mean, God's sake, I didn't ruin my Christmas, did I? But when Christmas had finished, I thought, okay, I'll get stuck in. And literally, that book was like a light bulb for me, because it opened up a whole new world. It introduced me to somebody else who was also not at rock bottom. Somebody else who was fully functioning, seemingly okay, professional, kids, everything's good, except it's not. And reading Claire's story literally gave me that hope. Oh my God, maybe, just maybe, there is life after the booze, maybe. And it felt terrifying and it felt scary. But I figured, well, you know, in honour of Claire, who was coming in on the 4th, maybe I'd stop and at least give Dry January a go. So I stopped drinking on the 30th of December. That's when I finished the book. And I figured, what's the point in doing anything else? So I drove us to the New Year party that we were going to. So that was my excuse for that one. And then when Claire finally came into the studio, I think I probably attacked you and asked you 1,000 questions. So, that's good as intro as any to Claire Pooley. Thank you so much, Claire.
It was a great day for me meeting you too.
It was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was fun.
And I'm going to try really hard not to burp.
Oh no, feel free. I don't mind anything like that, it's fine. I think most people here and most people listening to the podcast know of the Sober Diaries, but just briefly share the story of how it came about, because it was actually a blog for you originally, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I quit drinking 8 years ago now, so 2015, and, you know, like, my story is just the same as yours, really, and just the same as all of yours, and actually that's what I've learned through all of this, is that all our stories are so, so similar. But I didn't realise that then. I felt completely alone. I felt totally... I thought my life was over. I thought it was never going to be fun again, and this was my penance for all the good years I'd had, and now I had to pay for it. That's how I felt. And I was too embarrassed and ashamed to talk to anyone. I couldn't talk to my GP. I certainly couldn't go to AA. That sort of thought terrified me. I couldn't even talk to my friends and family. But I sort of had to get everything off my chest. So I thought, well, I'll write a diary, because that's what I did when I was a teenager. But that seemed a bit old-fashioned because, you know, 2015, people weren't writing diaries, they were writing blogs. And actually now nobody's writing blogs.
No, that's true.
So I thought, okay, I'm gonna try and write a blog. I had no idea how to go about it. So I sort of Googled how do I write a blog, and then I Googled how do I make sure nobody knows it's me. So I called myself Sober Mummy. I did it totally anonymously, and I called the blog Mummy Was a Secret Drinker, and I wrote in it every single day, and it became my therapy.
Yeah.
And everything, and I also read, like lots of you, I'm sure. I had a whole stack of books about quitting alcohol, and about memoirs and the book, AA book, everything all shoved under my bed. and I read, when I was writing in the blog, I would sort of share the stuff I'd learned. And I was really doing it just for me. And I wasn't publicising it, because to do that, I would have to come out from behind the pseudonym. So, you know, I didn't really expect very many people to find it, but it went viral. It sort of, I think because there were so many people out there just like me, it just spread through word of mouth. And within the first year, it had had about 2 million hits. I mean, it was extraordinary.
Amazing.
And then I decided to publish it as a memoir, The Sober Diaries. And the reason I wanted to do that is because I didn't want anyone else to have that feeling of I'm the only one.
Mm.
And my life is over and all of those sorts of things. And I realised quite how similar we all are. And I realised that all those books I'd read, you know, they, especially the memoirs, people would talk about, and it was normally men, and they would tell the story about how much they were drinking and how terrible it was. And you'd get to the end of the memoir and they'd say, and then I quit and now everything's great. And I think, hold on.
Yeah.
How did you quit? You know, how long did it take? What did you do? What did it feel like? How do you get through parties? What do you tell your friends? You know, I had so many questions.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
I thought nobody
was. Well, that
was
one of the things I loved about your book, was the fact that I'd read some books in the past when I'd been around the block. I'd certainly read I'd read Jason Vale's book,
Drink Easily.
And I think I then did stop drinking for a few months, actually, while the kind of brainwashing thing was there, you know, in a good way, until I was at a party and then there was only alcohol, and it's like, well, why would you not? You know, so I'd done a little bit of that, but nobody had ever looked at the kind of ups and downs, and that was one of the things I loved about your book. And I remember really clearly reading some of your descriptions of knowing that you just weren't really present as a parent, you know, in the same way, and you were rushing the bedtime story to get to the glass of wine. But one of the things I remembered so clearly about your book was when you described your journey to Cornwall. And that sort of trip from hell, you know, that anyone who, you know, lives in the, you know, anywhere that's 3 hours, 5 hours from Cornwall knows. If you try and do that trip with kids, well, that's hell, right?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
just is anyone's
in
definition
August.
Of hell.
Yeah.
In August, yeah. It just is. And you described it and the nightmare of packing the car and then the traffic on the M5 and everything. And then when you got there and you finally arrived, that's when you would have poured a drink.
Yeah,
isn't it?
So
totally.
I took some alcohol-free beer.
You had some beer, but you had no can opener. You had no bottle opener. And I was there at that. Oh, God, what should I do? So you cracked it on a tree. It's so rock and roll. Was it a tree or something?
No, it was a rock. It was a rock in the garden.
It's like, sod it, I need my alcohol-free beer.
But, you know what it's like with a rental property? You think, surely they've got a bottle opener. I went through every single drawer, every single cupboard. You know, my kids like, Mummy, can we go to the beach? I was like, no, I've got to find a sodding can opener. No bottle opener.
But it's that kind of level of real stuff that we need, right?
Yeah.
When we realise that, yes, that is exactly how we feel. So anyways, thank you for writing it. And I'm so impressed that it was such a massive success for you. I mean, God, just
Yeah, no, people
huge.
Are still reading it,
yeah,
which is amazing.
Of
so,
course.
You know, and it's, I get messages from people every day saying that it's really helped. So I'm really, because, you know, I have to confess that a few days before it came out, I really, if I'd been able to pull the plug, I would have done.
Yeah.
And, you know, I even sent an email to my agent saying, is it too late to change my mind? She went, yes. Because they'd lined you up.
Yeah, exactly.
The Woman's Hour and the Daily Mail, for God forbid, and the whole works.
Yeah. So huge congratulations. And then, you know, I think we should definitely touch on some of the stuff that's come after, because, you know, one of the things we talk about in the Sober Club all the time is how being sober makes you brave, right? Mm. And it also gives you back that sense of purpose and clarity and that energy for what else you want to do. Mm. And for you, you discovered that you were an absolutely unbelievable shit hot writer.
No, thank you.
Look at everything that's happened to you. It's just incredible. It's so exciting.
I think when you quit drinking, it leaves a big hole, doesn't it? You know, because you spend a lot of time, when you're a drinker, you spend a lot of time drinking, you spend a lot of time thinking about drinking, you spend
mopping
a lot of time
up from drinking.
Recovering from drinking. And so when you quit, you've got all this extra time on your hands, you've got a whole load of extra energy, you've got a whole load of extra creativity, and as you say, bravery. So, you know, I meet people all the time who, you know, after they've quit, have gone on to do extraordinary things. Yeah. And often it's the things that they were passionate about when they were teenagers.
Yes, and they just let slip.
Yeah, and that, for me, it was writing. That's what I loved doing when I was a teenager, and it, you know, I came back to it. But I have to say, I would caveat here, if you've only recently quit, don't expect that sort of thing to happen straight away, because the whole of the first year, at least, is sort of inwardly focused.
Yeah, it's like being a toddler, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're doing a really big job just getting through a year without drinking, so don't worry if you don't immediately set up a business or travel the world or become an artist.
That was another thing that you made really clear in your book, was the fact that all of life isn't instantly, you know, rainbows and bunnies.
Yeah.
And
it takes a while.
It takes a while. You know, you've got to find who you are.
After all those years of, you know, your subconscious telling you that sort of alcohol was absolutely fundamental to everything you did, you know, it does take a while to retrain your brain. But the second year, I find for most people, is the year when, you know, you suddenly start looking outwards and you think, okay, now I feel like a completely different person, and I've got all this time, I've got all this energy, what am I going to do with it? Yeah. So I think the second year is as transformative.
Definitely. And I think, you know, one of the things that's become really apparent to me, that the kind of theme of all of this really is connection. And at the beginning, when I first stopped, I didn't know anybody at all other than you. And that's why I kept emailing you. Mm. I should dig out those emails. Is it normal to have, like, leg cramps? Do you remember that one?
Often in the middle of the night as well.
We had nobody else to ask. Is it normal to have leg cramps? Probably just need a bit of magnesium, sweetheart. No. Is it normal to... I feel really shit and really miserable. I remember you wrote back to me and said, oh, sweetheart, you've probably just hit a wall. It does happen. You'll be all right. Do you remember all of that? Of course I do. And that's why we need connection with like minds. There's no point in asking somebody who hasn't been there, done it, got the T-shirt, those questions. It's so important, isn't it, to have those connections. So thank you.
Thank you.
In case anyone is not aware of your incredible success, just remind us of your books. The Authenticity Project was the first novel.
Yeah,
right?
so after I published The Sober Diaries, writing had become my new addiction, really, and I still had to write every day, but I didn't want to carry on writing about myself because I thought, I'm going to start really boring people here. And also my kids are getting older, so, you know, they're now teenagers and they don't want their mum talking in public about, you know, family life and
mine don't either,
but
stuff, that's just
you know,
tough.
I mean, that's so I thought, well, actually, you know, maybe I should just try writing fiction. And I'd always wanted to be a novelist. That was my big dream when I was little, but, you know, I never had the nerve. I never had the courage to finish a whole book and send it to agents and everything. But, you know, once you quit drinking, you do start feeling a bit like a superhero. You know, you sort of think, well, you know, what's the worst that can happen? You know, maybe I'll write it and nobody wants to publish it, so what? You know, I'll have fun doing it anyway. So I wrote this book. I went on a 3-month novel writing course, which was 2 evenings a week, and that sort of gave me the confidence to get to the end of my first draft of a book, which I called The Authenticity Project, which was about the amazing things that happen when you start telling the real truth about what's going on in your life. You can see where this, how this fits. It's slightly autobiographical. And then also included a character called Hazard, who is an addict, alcohol and cocaine addict. And, you know, I was able to sort of tell my story really through this character. And I remember actually writing, I wrote a part of this book. Hazard goes to a wedding and falls off the wagon. And I found that really difficult to write. And I remember talking to him in my head and saying, Hazard, I'm really sorry. I'm going to make you do something really awful here. But it's okay. It's all going to be okay in the end. So I wrote that book. And that became a New York Times bestseller.
Amazing.
And then I went on to write a second novel, which is called, in the UK, it's called The People on Platform 5. And that is... Actually, both that and the Authenticity Project are currently in the Amazon Top 100.
Amazing.
And I've got a new book coming out in May, which is called, this is my favourite title, it's called How to Age Disgracefully.
Fabulous. Sounds perfect.
Yeah.
I love it, Claire. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I'm just so impressed. And I just love all of you. I absolutely love your books. I love them. I think I've read The Authenticity Project 3 times.
Oh, thank you.
Practically starting to know it off by heart.
But look at what you've done since then. You know, I mean, that was only, we met 5.5 years ago.
Look at what
you've created.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Mutual appreciation. So thank you, Claire. I really appreciate it. I hope you'll hang around for a bit. Mm. And obviously, I mean, there's loads more we could chat about. But I think just, you know, that kind of top line message of go after your life, you know, because one woman, I forget who it was, but somebody I was coaching said to me, I feel like I've been given a second chance at life.
Yeah,
and I thought that really kind of sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's I feel like that. I feel like, and actually in the People on Platform 5, I have a character who called Iona Iverson who talks about how every woman deserves a magnificent second
yes,
act.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And I think quitting booze gives you a magnificent
yes,
second
totally.
Act.
Totally,
you know,
absolutely.
So hurrah for all of you and for all of us.
So Claire, thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Would you like support, connection and accountability on your sobriety and well-being journey? Join us in the Sober Club. Membership includes our online course, Get the Buzz Without the Booze. We have a huge portal of content, all kinds of incredible inspirational expert videos. And we have a course, Get the Buzz Without the Booze. We also have regular meetups and a Facebook group where you get connected with people who become your cheerleaders. TheSoberClub.com.
It's really amazing, isn't it? The power of connection. And even if you came here tonight not without knowing anybody, I'm guessing a few of you didn't know anyone. By the time you leave, hopefully you will. If you don't know anyone, please just go up and speak to people because we're very kind. You know, I do have this theory that being sober makes you kind. I do. I really do think the world would be a much nicer place if more people were sober. Welcome, William. It's so lovely to see you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you so much. Let me think. When I got introduced to your books, so I think as I was saying before, I'd read a few of the books around the logic of okay. not drinking. So I'd read Jason's book, and I know Jason really well. And I'd read Annie's book, I think, back at that point, Annie Grace. And I think I came across you when, we did the Self-Care for the Sober Curious events.
That's
a
right,
long time ago. In fact, Sober Dave
that's where I
came
first
along.
Met him.
He was only, most of, a lot of you know Sober Dave. And Sober Dave came along to these events, and he kind of wandered in. He'd only been sober for 2 weeks. Do you remember, bless him?
Yeah,
he was like one of those little chicks. That are just kind of like, oh,
quite
not,
a big chick.
Yeah, quite a big chick. Like, not quite sure where my feathers fit. Yeah, he was really fragile. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Bless his heart. So anyways, yeah, I remember, so I invited you to come and speak at that with Laura, I think.
Laura was probably there,
So I was lucky, wasn't I? I got all these amazing people. I don't know how I did that. How did I do that? It's amazing. It became apparent to me really quickly how powerful your books were, because you just explained stuff, you know, in a completely logical way. None of the fluff and the farting about that I do. Just here's how it is, right? And that's so important. And you know, I've since, well, as most people know, that William is contributor to our Sober Club and has done some fabulous exclusive stuff for us, and to the Sober Coach training that we do.
Yeah,
and there's
yeah.
a bunch of coaches here, and we're very grateful to you. So again, for anyone who hasn't heard your story before, just take us back as to how you came to write that book, those books, because you weren't even necessarily a writer before.
No, I wasn't, no. My story, I think it's very different in many ways, because I was a binge drinker. So, and it's just what we did in the growing up in the 90s. You know, you go out and get drunk. The whole purpose of drinking was to get drunk. It wasn't to have a couple of drinks and just be sociable. It was to go out and get as drunk as you possibly could. So I just did that for 25 years. And it got worse and worse and worse. And there were just like, there were increments where it got worse. And one of them, I'm sure many people who've heard me speak before have heard this story, but it was a Stephen King book where he was saying, one of the characters in there would get a crate of beer to watch baseball, and he'd keep a couple of beers back in the fridge. So when he woke up in the night, he'd have them to get back to sleep. And so I thought, oh, that sounds sensible, because I keep waking up in the night and I can't get back to sleep. And it worked a dream, because you have a couple of drinks, you relax, you fall back to sleep. But then, of course, the next night is the same. But then after a week or so of doing it, you need three drinks, and then four, and then five. And then you blur the line very badly between waking up in the morning and just drinking again. So when I was drinking in binges, I would start Thursday night, Friday lunchtime, whatever, and I would drink until I fell asleep and then wake up and then just start again. and of course, when you're doing that, you're in no fit state a lot of the time on a Monday to go into work. Mm. So I'd ring in sick, and then of course you're sat there with nothing to do but start drinking again. So these binges were just getting more and more dreadful, really. And they all came to a head in February 2014, where I woke up after 5 or 6 days of just constant drinking. I couldn't really remember what had happened. My wife was gone. She'd taken the boys with her. And that was it for me. That was the end. That was my rock bottom, which could have been worse, but it was pretty bad anyway.
Yeah. And when you decided to write the book, I think I've heard you say before that you did it almost for yourself, in that you really wanted to properly understand what alcohol did to the body. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I sometimes think of it, you know, Hercule Poirot, David Suchet, and he'd go in and kind of like obsessively straighten things. I kind of felt like that. I felt like alcohol was misunderstood at quite a drastic level. And it was, for me, it was almost like setting the record straight and just spelling it out. And it was really useful for me, because when I went through the process, it really helped solidify things in my mind. I've heard people say, if you want to know something really well, teach it. I would say write about it, because when you're setting it all out, you start to join more dots, and you also start to sort of spot some holes in your own thinking.
Was there anything that surprised you when you were doing that research in the early days? You know, was there anything? Because when I think back, I know that I genuinely did not know. I mean, it seems incredible to me now that I could have been so dim, but I genuinely didn't know how bad alcohol is for us. I just really didn't.
No, and to be honest, it's been an ongoing process for me as I've sort of moved through. And a lot of the stuff that was in the book has then been backed up. I don't know if you've heard. Have you heard of Why We Sleep by Matt Walker?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I've been reading that recently. I'm a few years behind the line with that, but it's so fascinating, and it sort of backs up everything that we're starting to learn or starting to understand about alcohol, about how addictive and how destructive it is. Mm. And that's one of the big things for me. One of the big things for me, I think, in quitting was understanding that those 3-4 a.m. wake-ups were alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely.
And understand
your liver trying to have a little
word with you. Absolutely. But just knowing the difference, how good it feels to wake up well-rested compared to not, and to realise that's being taken away from you by this supposedly harmless, wonderful thing.
Yeah,
real
exactly.
eye-opener. Yeah.
I think one of the other things that I really like about your work is you... there are so many things that you explain well, but one of the things that I have got you to do a whole session for us on in for our coaches is this whole idea of how we look back with rose-coloured glasses. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
you know, the fading effect bias.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that, because we very often get messages in the Sober Club from somebody going, well, you know, I've got a wedding coming up, you know, and... big wedding. I've got a wedding coming up, you know, soon, and you know, there's going to be alcohol. I mean, you know, maybe thinking about it the last time, and it was just so lovely, and you can just hear the thought process. I mean, thankfully they're sharing it, so everyone else can go, don't do it. But just tell you know, for anyone who's not aware of that, just explain how it kind of goes.
So it's called fading effect bias, and it's a psychological mechanism whereby humans tend to look back on past events more positively than they actually experienced them. And what's really interesting about it is it's universal, so it's not just Western people who suffer from this, it's global, so any human being has this. They just have this tendency, when looking back at the past, to see it more positively, which is kind of good in a way, because it helps you maintain a positive outlook in life generally, but it's not good when it comes to addiction, because you quit something. You know, we're all there, we're drinking, we're not getting anything out of it, we don't like it, we don't like the life we're living, we quit. But then as time starts to pass, you forget the 99% of it that you didn't like, and you remember that one time that you really enjoyed a drink, for example, at a wedding or on a holiday or whatever it is. And those positive memories last longer. So when you've stopped drinking, you forget the hangovers, the waking up at 3 a.m, all of that. You even forget the slumped on the sofa bit where you're drinking, supposedly enjoying it, and you're just comatose and don't really know what's going on. But you remember, like I say, that 1% that was really enjoyable, and that becomes, oh, I really enjoy drinking.
Yeah. So what really changed for you then when you'd kind of done all of this research? Was that what enabled you to kind of think, do you know what, I really am not going to do this anymore?
I think it was a mix of things for me. So I quit when I came... It's very good, because people often say to me, you know, did you know you weren't going to drink again? How did you feel at the time? Honestly, when I came out of that last drinking session, I don't think I could string a coherent thought together. I was in a really bad way, and all I had in mind was, I cannot keep doing this. I'm going to lose the family, job, house. It's all going to go. I can't keep doing it. But my mindset was probably very similar to Claire's. It was, I have to give this up, but life's going to be pretty unpleasant without it, because I'm not going to enjoy holidays. Who goes on holiday without a drink and actually enjoys themselves? And Christmas, and I don't like socialising. The only thing I like about socialising is the alcohol. So I'm no longer
terrible, going to... all this absolute
absolutely.
BS that we've been led to believe all these goddamn years.
At that point, that was... But of course you don't. You go out and it's like, you go on holiday and it's like, I do enjoy holidays.
Yeah,
of course
exactly.
You do.
Far more.
And so it was kind of, it wasn't just that I did all the research and then stopped. It continued afterwards to fall into place.
Mm, yeah. And so just remind us what else you've, because, you know, since you've done two versions of Alcohol Explained, right? Yeah. And you've got a course and workbooks and stuff. But we should also give a mention to your other books, because they're really great too. So, Diet and Fitness Explained, I've got the title right.
Yes.
I mean, I really love that, because again, you know, I thought with all my kind of years of writing books and all the stuff I've done, I don't think there was really much about nutrition that anyone could teach me. But again, you do that thing of, right, well, I'm just going to go at it with a complete, total logic. And you just kind of lay it out there, and it's really well done.
Thank you.
I mean, tell us a bit about that book for anyone who hasn't seen it.
So that was, again, it was, I'm a big believer in our bodies speak to us in quite a loud voice, but we're very, very good at ignoring it. So for me, it was almost taking a step back and, you know, not to have... not to belittle what you do or anything, but there's a lot of people talking about nutrition and nutritionists, and you should eat that and you shouldn't eat that. Yeah. And for me, it was almost like, well, why? Yeah, it was almost like, so I trust that things that taste and feel good are probably good for you, and things that don't aren't. But then it's like, well, hang on, I like pizzas and burgers. Well, hang on, let's think about what you actually enjoy when you're eating these things. So it was a similar thing. It was almost like a drains-up approach.
Yeah.
Just let's stop and really go get under the skin of this. Look at the foods we're eating. How do they make you feel? How do they actually taste? And sort of went through it that way.
Mm. Yeah, it was really good. And I think it's a very good introduction for people, certainly if you stop drinking and then you get the old sugar monster, you know, the sugar head on, it's really good to be reminded, you know, of those of those facts, and the fact that artificial sugar is, you know, the devil's own work, you know, which you lay out quite clearly. So I thought it was great. And also nicotine explained. Now, thank God I've never been a smoker, but I have a friend who found that book really, really helpful.
Well, that's good too.
So again, how did you approach that one?
So that was a similar one. So I stopped smoking using Alan Carr's method.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it took me a lot of attempts, and there were a few bits in there that didn't quite ring true for me and wasn't my experience. So it was almost like a similar approach, a drains up approach, but just applying my own experience to it. So that, yeah, that was another one quite interesting,
So well done. I mean, it's just amazing. And tell us about the stuff that you've done with Annie Grace.
So that was another nicotine book. So that was a sort of a melded approach between Naked Mind and Explained, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And so we co-wrote the book on that. So that was another nicotine one, specifically nicotine, because obviously vaping's becoming the big thing now.
Yeah, tell us your view on that.
So I think people need to get away, because how it's perceived at the moment is it's less harmful than smoking.
Mm.
But I think we need to accept the fact that it's not good for you.
Mm.
And forget the fact it's not good for you. Like a lot of these drugs, it actually detracts a lot more than you think it does. So when you're actually taking it, you do feel better, but you miss the big picture because it drags you down so much before it does that. One of the big things nicotine does is it puts your heart rate up really high.
Mm-hmm.
When your heart rate goes up, you want to sit down and rest. Okay, that's just a mechanism within you. So when you're taking nicotine in any form, your ability and enjoyment of exercise just drops completely. That has a massive effect on your physical and mental well-being, but most people don't appreciate that. And I think we need to get the conversation away from it's better than smoking, which it might well be, to this is hugely damaging, not just in 40 years' time when you have chronic heart disease, but here and now in your quality of life.
Mm.
And I think if there is a message, that's it. These drugs, all of them, they take far more than they give, and not just in reduced longevity, but in the here and now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What's next for you then?
Caffeine.
Oh, please. I've just had the most fantastic espresso martini, courtesy of Club Soda here. And I'm not sure I want to read that one.
So
you killjoy.
I know. Everything's gone now. There'll be nothing, no pleasures left in the world.
You'll be
doing sex next.
Come on then, tell us what's so terrible about caffeine.
Well, no, I haven't quite written the book, I'm still doing the research on it, but it's really interesting, and of all the drugs I've given up, this is the one that I had to abandon my attempt because I couldn't function.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't drinking massive amounts of caffeine, but I could not work, I could not digest information in written form. So I had to abandon it and do it when I was on holiday. And I wasn't drinking massive amounts, I was having 4 or 5 cups of green tea a day.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's not massive amounts of caffeine, and I'm working with other people, specifically someone who drinks a lot of coffee, and she has done since she was 13, and she was in a very bad way and had to quit. So in terms of, we perceive caffeine as harmless, but it isn't. There's quite a lot to it. So, and this is an interesting one. Every other book I've written it having stopped it.
Yeah.
But I've started writing this one not having stopped it. So I was still drinking it. I was very happy with my caffeine intake, you know, a few cups of green tea a day. And my plan was to do the research.
Well, that sounds very holy to me.
Yeah.
I prefer a flat white myself.
So my plan was to do the research, stop for a bit, and then just decide whether to go back or not. And actually, there's enough benefits that have really made it worthwhile. So
benefits of not drinking it. Oh, so
yeah,
you're
yeah.
gonna say.
I'm afraid not. No.
Right. Well, I
on
wish
happy
you
note.
Lots of success. Probably won't be reviewing that one. Not just yet. I mean, you know,
yeah,
give a girl a break.
Give it a break. Yeah.
It's exciting. I mean, it is very exciting because not many people touch that topic.
No. I don't think it's going to be my best selling.
Being
book.
Sober makes you brave,
yes.
right? Being yeah. sober makes you brave enough yeah, to bring yeah. out a book that nobody wants to read that one. I'm just joking. No, we absolutely need to read it. It sounds
yeah.
good. that's exciting. It's good. I don't know how on earth you find time. You're very prolific with the old books, aren't you?
Yeah, I can't. I always can't resist it.
I mean, given you've got a real job,
I
how
know,
do you do
yeah,
it?
And family, it's, I almost can't resist, like, drinking, for example, caffeine, just thinking, hang on,
yeah.
can you improve things?
It's, you've got what they call an inquiring mind.
Yeah.
Inquisitive,
yes.
Well, we're very grateful, and thank you so much for all your amazing books and all your amazing work, and thank you for agreeing to come.
Oh, my pleasure.
So lovely of you to come and join
again.
Us.
Thank you.
So thank you, William Porter.
Is it time for you to break the cycle? Maybe you've heard me speak about family constellations, all kinds of entanglements that might be holding you back. Grab a fresh perspective. Come and join us for our Family Constellations workshop in Hertfordshire, Sunday, October the 15th. Go to thesoberclub.com, click on events, and hopefully we'll see you there. Come with an open mind.
So, yes!
Thank you,
Laura Willoughby, how fantastic is this incredible space, honestly. We just love it, don't we, guys?
It actually needs to be bigger, right?
Yes.
So maybe soon.
Maybe you'd like to describe it for anyone listening who is actually here. Just describe what we've got here in this magical space.
Yeah, so many people may have known that we ran a lot of mindful drinking festivals for a long time. And then after lockdown, we did a pop-up shop where you could try literally everything in the shop. There was over 140 brands in the shop. It was very sticky. But what we realised is that now was probably the right time to open a tasting room. Being able to try before you buy is a really important part. Finding a drink that you would like to, you know, switch out in your diet to something else. And so we took the plunge and we found this space. We did a reward-based crowdfunder to open it. So if any of you donated, you'll probably sat on the chair that you funded. My mother is the dishwasher. It's Hillary. She's done a lot of time washing glasses at festivals. She doesn't have to do that anymore. So we now have this tasting room, which is a mixture of a shop and bar and training space. We do a lot of training of pubs and bars and restaurants here, and helping them develop their menus, which to me is really important, because our goal as a social impact business is to make sure that there's drinks for everyone everywhere you go. And you'll see, thanks to IKEA, we've got some great flip-up tables, and we've got a bar, so you can come and have great drinks. And we've really lucked out with this amazing bar team that we have here, who can create and make amazing cocktails, which is something I never thought we would actually get, but we have. So it's a multi-purpose, multi-use space. It's here for you guys to use.
It is fantastic. We so appreciate it. Just take us back.
Should I tell you the funny bit about it, though? Which is probably a good answer to your question you're about to ask. Sorry, Janie. Which is, it's also opposite the pub I had my last drink in. Just really,
all
really speaking.
Circle.
So that Green King in the corner, don't look at Freemasons Hall, I wasn't in there. The Green King on the corner is where I had my last drink after going to see What the Butler Saw by Joe Orta, and I went there on the way home.
You remember
so there we
it
are.
Well.
I do.
So what is it, 9, 10 years for you?
11 years. Honestly, I didn't think I'd be saying that I hadn't drunk for 11 years. It's flown by.
Amazing. So just take us back then a little bit and just tell us a little bit about what happened for you. And I'm particularly interested in how you got so interested in the whole world of alcohol-free drinks, which for many people
wasn't
here...
Wasn't where it started.
No, I'm sure. But for many people here, it was literally is the game changer. So, you know, you are so important in all of this.
Yeah,
so, many of us.
Well, it's worth reflecting on what I did before now, which is I'm a campaigner by background. I've been campaigning since I was 14. I lived in Paddy Ashdown's constituency. I went to his surgery when I was 14 to ask how to become an MP. I ran everything in my town, the Environment Committee, the Women in Music Committee. I was on it. I went to ask for skateboard ramps. I didn't even skateboard, you know, all of that sort of shit. So there's something about me that's an activist and a campaigner. And when I graduated and moved to London, I got elected to Islington Council when I was 23, which meant that I ended up in a career that's mostly fueled by cheap white wine. And I've always been a big drinker. Like most people here, we're of a generation where we probably drank cider at the village hall when you were 14 and all of that sort of stuff. No, you say. Guilt. Look at that face. You know, it's when you have to stop drinking, when you go to work in the pub that you've been drinking in all that time, because they suddenly realise how old you are. And so I've always been a big drinker. I'm very much like my father, and actually alcohol did kill my father when I was 30. So I was already worried about my drinking at that point. I knew as my father's daughter, I inherited his drinking habits and his boobs. So I began to panic when I was 30, and I went and did lots of tests, and it was to check my liver, as if that strange test that they do that just says that it's working or not working would actually tell me the real story. And I was already worried about my drinking when I was 30. But like most people, you know, I knew that there was a problem. So what I did is I drank like all of the alcohol in the world was going to disappear.
Yeah.
Which is now what I do basically with cake. I went from being a big drinker to what I consider to be problematic in my drinking, because I ended up in a job that I wasn't enjoying. And for someone who's been always identified by the job that I did, the good that I did in the world, the things that I campaigned for, the things I wanted to change, I had amazing opportunities. I did some amazing stuff. You know, I was chair of the local government nationally. I was chair of the local government committee on equalities, bringing in equal marriage. I worked for Stonewall. You know, I did lots of things that I'm really proud of. But there comes a point when I was in a job I wasn't enjoying, and so it was really easy for me to go, no one cared if I turned up, which sounds amazing, doesn't it? To have a job where no one cares if you turn up. Terrible for me. All my self-identity and self-worth sort of disappeared, and it was really easy to go out and have boozy lunches. And so I wasn't a daily drinker because I couldn't drink on a hangover, but I was an every other day drinker, and it was like an extreme sport. I don't have kids, I had no one to get home for, you know, so it was really easy for me to carry on that drinking habit that I had. And I was really worried, and then one day, I mean, there's a really interesting story about this, but I can't tell you all because it will reveal names. But needless to say, I went home with someone else that I shouldn't have gone home with on an evening, who after deciding that I was going to change my drinking, I'd already decided, I told my friends the look of relief in their face. I said, I've booked on a course, I'm going to go on this course. I then woke up with this woman who I'm very pleased that I did, because she looked at me and went, "Ah, you're a functioning alcoholic, aren't you?" What do you mean? After we had both got completely slaughtered the night before, as if she didn't know what I was. And she said, "Well, you're just like me. We drink in a very similar way, and we're both fucking up our lives." And so when I went and did the course that I did, which is another story, she gave up with me. And whilst it wasn't a very long-lasting relationship, it did actually get me through the first few months, because there's nothing more exciting than a new relationship. So it's quite enjoyable. But also, she actually fell off the wagon several times, and it was horrible, and I didn't want to go through that myself. So I am actually grateful for the times that she fell off the wagon and showed me that. She's now alcohol-free, by the way, and has managed to deal with that for herself as well. But it's I accidentally did some really good behaviour change things at the time, finding someone to change drinking with. For me, anger's a good motivator. The course I went on was shit and unethical, and I came out of it really angry that people pay money for something which is wrong. I wouldn't mention the course, but you did talk about Alan Carr Easy Way Smoking. The Alan Carr Easy Way Drinking, do not send anybody on. It is you should not put people in a room who are dependent drinkers, tell them to stop drinking immediately, and then give them no support. But I like to solve problems, so I ruminated on this for quite a bit of time. Like, why is it that you can turn up and pick up a magazine about dieting? Who's got their trolley out? Somebody's got a trolley out. This isn't a quiet part of town. So how is it you can turn up, and it's okay to buy a diet magazine in the newsagents, but there's nothing to help you change your drinking. why isn't there the equivalent of Slimming World? And so I gave up my job. I actually managed to get another job in the meantime, which was running a bank switching campaign. But I then decided, I went on a course or a programme designed for people coming out of public sector to look at businesses that they could do to change the world. And this is what I picked.
Mm.
And that's where it started.
Wow. So some of the work that you've done, you know, over the years has been, I mean, literally incredible. And I think when I first stopped drinking and I first became aware that there was a world of, you know, there's a whole world of people who don't drink, like, who knew? And I became aware of the Mindful Drinking Festival. I think that was the first thing I became aware of. You were doing something in the summer somewhere.
Yeah, it was that first one in 2017 where we had to scrape 20 brands onto Bermondsey Square. Like, I had to work really hard to get enough drinks to go onto that festival.
I think it was 2018 I would have come.
Yeah.
And it was, and it literally, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe what I was seeing. So that was my first introduction to this whole world of, hold on a minute, you can actually drink something else. You know, it doesn't have to be a Coca-Cola.
But that's because there wasn't anything else.
Well,
so
exactly.
We started in 2015, and just like you, I started a community, and lots of people started to talk on Facebook, and everyone started to go, oh, well, it's okay, Laura, saying to go out and not drink, and it's okay for you that you're happy to take your own drink into a pub, but look, some of us don't like those arguments that you have. why are things not a bit better? So I actually got some funding from Hackney Council in end of 2015-16, and we did our first ever report called Nudging Pubs, where we went and visited all of the pubs in the Dalston area. It's a very posh word for a pub crawl. And we went to look at what it is that they served, why they served it, why they didn't have anything better. And we found a number of things in that piece of research. One was is that basically pubs run by women invest. Yay! And the second is that there wasn't enough product out there. So while some pubs wanted to have something different, it was Beck's Blue or bust, basically.
Mm.
And so when we launched off the back of that our pub guide, and we basically visited 400 pubs in Hackney and City of London to build that guide and to talk to those pubs in the end of 2016 when there still wasn't hardly anything available about a low and no, and it was still quite a hostile environment for that discussion then. But we began to find that there were chinks of light, particularly by venues owned by younger people. I was nicknamed the alcohol-free beer lady in the Holy Shoreditch, which is not what I was called before, I can tell you. So basically, you can't keep a good campaigner down. And whilst I did want to do a proper grown-up business, this physical space here is the embodiment of a campaign that I've basically been running. And so more and more we're leaning into one particular behaviour change technique, which is switching an alcoholic drink for an alcohol-free one, and talking to venues about a quality of experience. My money's as good as anyone else's. I might not have as many drinks as a whole in the evening, but I'm definitely having dessert now.
Mm-hmm.
So my money's just as good as anyone else's. And that's the conversation we've been having. And what's happened is that the hospitality sector, we came, you know, there's a lot of good timing around this. So Heineken Zero came on the market, and then Big Drop and Seedlip and those things.
Mm.
At a time when we started to talk about this, and then people started to ask me to talk at hospitality events. If you had told me 11 years ago, I would now be ranked number 16 of the most influential people in the drinks industry right now, I would have laughed. But I now see that I have a particular role in the whole of this space that I can do. And also, 11 years ago, if you told me I'd be going to speak at Bulk Wine Fair, I would have thought that would have been a terribly good few days. I don't know what I'm going to drink there, but I think that's going to be rather funny, don't you?
Totally. But it is incredible, isn't it, when we look at this rise in availability and choice. And it's literally incredible. Just even just in the 5.5 years that I've been sober, I mean, the change has been huge.
But it's huge because people are moderating as well. It's not just about us people who have gone alcohol-free.
True. Yeah, I did see a study about saying something like, I think it said something like 29% of pub visits are now alcohol-free.
When I started Club Soda, 1 in 7 visits to the pub were alcohol-free, depending on whose data you look at. Now it's about 1 in 3, 1 in 4.
Mm-hmm.
And restaurants lose £800 million by not upgrading you from a tap water to something you pay for.
Mm.
And the reason why this market exists is because people are not drinking as much as they were. If it was just for this 4 million sober people, then it wouldn't be a market. But it's actually for 25, 30 million people who are moderating their drinking. So we all have something in common. So it doesn't matter what anyone's drinking relationship with alcohol is or what your drinking habits are. If you're looking to change your drinking in any way, we all have something in common. Mm. And everyone who's moderating their drinking is helping put better product on the shelf that benefits us all.
Yeah.
And to be honest, all there was Crodino when I gave up drinking, and it was a real hard, slog to work out what to drink instead. But now the options are wide, and there's still a lot of work to do. Trust me, I go to loads of places and there's still no options.
Yeah. Well, I
know what I want to do now to make that happen, and that's what we're focusing on next.
And I think you've made a massive difference in terms of what pubs offer. I know that you actively try and encourage people to contact pubs, and to if they go into a pub, you encourage them to actually say, think about stocking
X and Y.
Yeah,
there's nothing like a campaign, right? Let's storm
exactly.
The barricades. Let's do a sit-in in the Green King. Let's let them know that we're not happy. There's going to be more of that to come.
Good. But what I was going to say was, I think has been a massive change there. I've definitely seen it. But the catering world is still what frustrates me, because, I go, I speak at various events, award ceremonies, whatever, a health show, and I can't get my head around the fact that you're in this massive conference centre that people have paid a fortune for the goddamn catering, and it's literally, you get to the event, the awards event, big old flash thing, and there's champagne, a thing of beer, and literally for the non-drinkers, you're very lucky if there's some warm orange juice.
Well, 30p on a carton of concentrated orange juice, I hope you feel special. It's not good, is it? But that's because we're a very alcohol-centric country, and there's lots of things that just happen that we've never questioned before. Like every single awards dinner at a hotel is catered on a 3-course meal and half a bottle of wine. Mm. If you're not drinking, you have to go to the bar and get something yourself and pay for it. And the idea that moderation might be for everybody in the room is completely alien. There's also a big issue around wholesalers, so in-house caterers. If any of you work for a company that's got in-house caterers, they all order from Bid Foods or Sodexo, and so the range of alcohol-free is shit on those. And so until we can change the wholesalers, which is what I'm trying to do, then they won't get that change. Our next step is that we will become a wholesaler ourselves, a wholesaler and distributor, so that we can be that one point of order, so they can get a mixed palette of product and have it, both the wholesalers and individuals caterers, because these are the levers of change that still need to happen. And so those are what I'm working on, and that's where my efforts and the team's efforts here are best spent, because we know how to do that. Every time Noah puts a cocktail up on Instagram, loads of people in the sector go, well, that looks prettier than the cocktails that we do. What is it that they know that we don't? And people come to us and ask. Yeah. Every time I do a panel, at a trade show, people come and talk to us. And, we've had, like, a couple of weeks ago, the head of drinks for the whole of the Hakkasan group, some of the biggest restaurants in the world came in and said, well, how can you help us choose our alcohol free? At which point I went, help, I'm quite sure, you're very fancy pants, I can't even afford to go to your restaurant, what are you on about? But that's the position that we're in, and so I need to work out how I can help all of you become part of that story.
Yeah.
and advocate better and feel confident to go, this pub or bar or restaurant's got a shit option, but if I can at least raise it in a kind and nice way, then I'll make it better for the person that comes along behind me.
Yeah.
And how we reward and celebrate the venues that do it really well is also a really important part of that. Everybody loves 5-star reviews on TripAdvisor and Google, just in case anyone's wondering, we're on both.
But just remind me, have you've got your pub guide?
We don't have the pub guide anymore.
Okay.
Because we were about to redo it just before lockdown and every pub closed. But actually, now I would recommend for pubs and bars to put their menu on Google. Google now has such a good menu function.
Yeah.
Like if you were to stand in the middle of Soho and type in Lucky Saint or Everleaf or any of the brands in this shop, it will bring
up
this
yeah.
shop. That's far more powerful than me creating another destination for people to go to find information. So we've got a whole suite of tools that venues can use to promote what they have and to make sure that they don't hide it and that they actually put it on the menu, they put it on their chalkboard, having different menus for lunchtime and the start of the week rather than at weekends for drinks, because most people don't drink at lunchtime anymore. It's not 1980s. So,
do you remember that?
Yeah.
God. I used to work at, when I was a presenter on GLR.
I know.
I mean, just roll out from the show into the pub.
I know. So, you know, things are changing. So we need to help pubs and bars. And, you know, it's a terrible time for hospitality anyway, both in terms of staffing and energy costs. Like, the energy costs even for this tiny shop are ridiculous. So, you know, it's about working with them and telling them what you'd like to see and saying that, you know, you would come more often. Venues that have a good alcohol-free range notice that group bookings are bigger because people are likely to look at their menu in advance and go, right, there's vegan food for so-and-so and there's alcohol-free drinks for so-and-so, so that's a good destination for us to go. These are all nuggets which I want to give you and have more time to give you so that you feel empowered as well. We're still a tiny team, but we punch well above our weight.
You really do. And I think, you know, your message... I'm sure you'd agree, is that, you know, we want it to be as normal to choose not to drink as to drink. It's not about prohibition. You know, we're just saying it should be completely normal. You know, we don't need the sober shamers. We don't need to feel as though there's nothing for us. It just needs to be... I mean, as you say, if someone goes into a cafe or a restaurant now, if there were no vegetarian or vegan options... I mean, what the hell?
Yeah.
They'd be closed down practically.
You'd be in France.
It'd just be bizarre.
That's where you'd be. I mean, we have alcohol in the shop. Just so you know, we've got a low alcohol section. I'm very committed to supporting the growth of low, which I think will come on the back of this, so that people know there's a lot of 6% wines coming through and stuff like that. And while they might not be for us in this room, if they are a step for people to reevaluate changing their drinking, then because for me, mindful drinking is just about what you drink when you are drinking as what you drink when you're not. And so I want to get away from that binary thinking that either you're drinking or not drinking. Instead, people to have a thoughtful approach to how they drink, and if they are going to drink alcohol, to save it for the time, the place, the people, the drink that they like the most, and cut out all of those incidental glasses of wine that you hardly even notice during the week. Wouldn't we have all been in a better place if we had had that approach when we're joining Jamie's club, right?
Let me just ask you one question, which I remember asking you when I was very early days.
Shit, how do you still have a memory? I thought there were two things that would improve with giving up drinking, my memory and sleeping with inappropriate people, and neither
of them. So I remember asking you when I was only a few weeks in, I sidled up and I said, whatever it was you'd given me a glass of, I've had that last night and the night before and, you know, tonight, and am I going to get addicted to that? And it's a question that people ask me, and your answer was, if I remember rightly...
No, because it's got no alcohol in it.
Exactly.
It's not addictive. It's not addictive. I mean, people throw that word addiction around quite liberally. Oh, you're addicted to exercise. Oh, you're addicted... You know, no, there's addiction and there's... You know, whenever I'm out, I want to drink the same drinks. Or whenever I'm in front of the TV, I'd like to have something that isn't what I've been drinking to rehydrate all day. And also, you know, once there's no alcohol in beer, it's really healthy for you. It's got no sugar in it. It's full of vitamin B12. It's a good recovery drink after exercise. I mean, it's amazing. So it's one of those really weird drinks that is totally the opposite. All of these drinks are designed by people who want it to be an adult drink. They're all lower in sugar. They're working really hard, particularly in the wines, which have to have some flavour added back in to bring down the sugar levels. So this isn't about being unhealthy. And in fact, you'll probably find that some of these drinks are a lot healthier than some of the sodas you can drink. So it's about just a different drink with a different taste profile for a different time of day that suits a particular occasion, that makes you feel included. And every time I talk to anybody in this space, they go, well, what's the point? So I said, there's two really important things in every bottle here. One is that it feels like a reward, because alcohol was a key part of our reward structure. So does it feel special? Does it feel like, yeah, I've worked hard today, I deserve something that tastes nice? Does it feel like a reward? And the second is it's social inclusion in a bottle. You don't feel like you're treated differently, like you've got half a pint of Coke in a glass with a straw, like you're about 12 and about to go wait in the car park with your dad. You've got a drink that looks and feels the part, that's got speed humps in, that stop you from drinking too fast, that makes you feel like it suits the occasion, rather than that you're having a secondary experience. For me, this is all about a quality of experience.
Yeah, thank you. So just finally then, I know you've got loads of plans, and there's lots more to come. What's next? I mean, just for anyone who hasn't yet been to this fabulous place, just remind us of when you're open so that people can come here, and then tell us what's exciting for the future.
Cool. So we're opening Covent Garden. So we're on Drury Lane, which is the corner of Longacre and Drury Lane. We're open 7 days a week, and we're open till 7:30 at least during the summer, in the start of the week, and then till 10 p.m. on a Thursday, Friday and Saturday. We've got an amazing bar menu, so we've got cocktails, we've got beer on draft, we've got wine by the glass, but we're also a tasting room, so you'll see this little fridge here, it's full of things that you can taste, and everything here is a consultative sale, so we will aim to find you the drink that's right for you. It's not about you going away with something and going, well, you know, I felt like I had to buy something. We want you to go away with something that you like. We also have events and training in here and all sorts of other things, but everybody's welcome. We do need more people to come in, because Covent Garden isn't cheap. We were aspirational. We felt this is where Low and No belonged, right in the centre of town, and being shishi and as nice as everything else. I do want to open more spaces. The whole point of the spaces is to be a catalyst for change. They're not about being a retail space in their own right. They're about working with the whole of the hospitality sector in an area and saying, right, we want to help you attract more diverse customers. And the Greater Manchester Authority is really keen for us to move in. They really want us to help look at that diversity of experience in that region. So that would be a great place for us to be. But as I said, there's still this missing piece of being able to encourage other wholesalers to stock alcohol free, and also to be able to wholesale at low MOQs, as they call them, but minimum quantities, because most people get alcohol trucked in by the truckload. You won't get through that much alcohol free, but most people go, well, I can't take that much beer on, I can't have a whole pallet of beer. What I want is a pallet with some beer on, some wine on, some cider on, and so on. And so we're looking at how we can do more of that. We have got the respect and the attention of the hospitality sector, which I never thought we would do. We're in a very unique position to be able to change this. And so I need to be able to take that and run with it. So we're just looking at how we do that. So we're looking for investment for the first time, which I really hate doing. But we don't need a lot, but it means I can bring people who know what they're doing, because contrary to what it might look like, I don't. I need people who understand about wholesale and retail and about training venues and all of that sort of stuff, so we can begin to change that and make it a lot easier for venues to have more low and no.
Fantastic. Laura, thank you so much. Thank you.
Just to let you know that, we've got stuff open to sample. We are open for a while longer after we finish speaking. So do take advantage, particularly if some of you have come a long way or won't get here very often. Don't feel you just suddenly have to leave the door and not get to try anything. We have got an amazingly qualified team. They are actually more qualified than me, which is how you're meant to run a business. You're always meant to employ people who are better qualified than you. So do take advantage. We're in no rush. We're not going to kick you out the door. I'd rather, particularly those of you who have taken a long time to get here, to make the most of your opportunity here. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Laura. So all that's left then is for me to say a massive thanks to Laura and this amazing team for making us these incredible drinks and hosting us in this fantastic space. And as I say, you're very welcome to stay around. Huge thank you to Claire. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for all your incredible work. And thank you to William. Thank you so much. Again, all your amazing work. Thank you for coming and being part of this and supporting us. And thank you to you all for coming down. It's just been so lovely, such an amazing connection, a really amazing connection in this space. It's really lovely. And to anyone listening, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I can't believe the amount of episodes. I just can't believe it. If you've only just come across it, then you can go back and binge on them, on lots of them. I only started the podcast all that time ago because I'd kind of run out of podcasts to listen to, and it seemed too long to wait for another one to come around. So I figured, maybe I just better start my own, and particularly as I had become aware of some amazing people that I wanted to interview. So I think things like podcasts and Quitlet can just be so massively important in those early weeks for people. So if the podcast has been part of your journey, then I'm really grateful that I was able to do it. And thank you. Actually, quite a few people in this room have been guests. So put your hand up if you've been a guest on the podcast. Look at that. See, I just invited all my guests. Everyone here is already a guest on the podcast, so...
And everyone else wants to know why they...
So, obviously, if you're feeling left out at this point, I'm sure there'll be a space for you. So thank you. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for making suggestions and letting me know what your favourite episodes were. If anyone does have great recommendations for me, then feel free to let me know, because I'll carry on doing it as long as there's inspirational people to talk to, which I'm sure will be for a very long time. So thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Noah. And thank you so much. The drinks are just amazing, so please make sure you sample. And thank you to Cindy, who made it all happen.
Thank you so much for everything that you do in this community. I just want to say a very big thank you to Janie for everything she does in this community. She does so much for us, and also for raising awareness as well out there in the public space. So we really appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Thank you, Sydney. I appreciate it. And if anyone is not a member of the Sober Club, I mean, why not? They're my final words. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.